From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, comic Lewis Black. He's been described as having the mouth of a shock jock and the heart of a liberal, but his rants are targeted at just about anyone or anything he finds deserving, from politics to the weather. He's a regular commentator on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He has a new memoir called Nothing Sacred. Also, we remember the writer and Nobel laureate Saul Bellow. He died Tuesday at the age of 89. We'll listen back to a 1989 interview. And we'll listen to a 1993 interview with the writer and teacher Frank Conroy, author of the influential memoir Stop Time. He died yesterday at the age of 69. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel, Night and Day, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. And from Jeep, introducing the trail-rated Jeep Liberty CRD with next-generation diesel technology. Emissions and performance capabilities at jeep.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The novelist and Nobel Prize winner Saul Bellow died Tuesday at the age of 89. In his New York Times obituary, Mel Gussow and Charles McGraw describe Bellow as the self-proclaimed historian of society whose fictional heroes and whose scathing, unrelenting, and darkly comic examination of their struggle for meaning gave new immediacy to the American novel in the second half of the 20th century. Bellow's best-known novels include The Adventures of Augie March, Henderson the Rain King, Herzog, and Humboldt's Gift. In addition to the Nobel, Bellow won 3 Pulitzer Prizes, 3 National Book Awards, and a Presidential Medal. He's regarded as a great American writer, but he grew up in Quebec, to Jewish immigrant parents from Russia. I spoke with him in 1989 after the publication of his novella, The Bellarosa Connection. The narrator, who heads an Institute for Memory Technique in Philadelphia, tells the story of his late friend, a Jewish immigrant who was saved from the Holocaust in an escape operation overseen by the Broadway producer Billy Rose. I asked Saul Bellow to read the opening of the book.
As founder of the Mnemosyne Institute in Philadelphia, 40 years in the trade, I trained many executives, politicians, and members of the defense establishment. And now that I am retired, with the Institute in the capable hands of my son, I would like to forget about remembering, which is an Alice in Wonderland proposition. In your twilight years, having hung up your gloves or sheathed your knife, you don't want to keep doing what you did throughout your life. A change, your kingdom for a change. A lawyer will walk away from his clients, a doctor from his patients. A general will paint China, a diplomatist turned to fly fishing. My case is different in that I owe my worldly success to the innate gift of memory. A tricky word, innate, referring to the hidden sources of everything that really matters. As I used to say to clients, memory is life. That was a neat way to impress a member of the National Security Council whom I was coaching. But it puts me now in an uncomfortable position because if you have worked in memory, which is life itself, there is no retirement except in death.
So Bellow, as this character tells us in the first paragraph, he wants to forget about remembering. Has this been a period where memory has been especially persistent or troubling to you?
Well, I seem to be one of these curious cases of a person whose memory is continuous. Nietzsche wrote an essay on history in which he says some rather curious things about remembering. He says a strong man can forget those things that will injure him. And I suppose that that's true, so that the power of forgetting should be paired with the power of memory, because the capacity to forget is will preserve your life in some instances. On the other hand, there is no continuity in human life without memory. It's one of the things that distinguishes us from the animals. Not all of us want to be distinguished, but if you insist on distinguishing, making such a distinction, this is one of the main points to bear in mind.
I want to quote something that you wrote in 1987. This was in an essay in the New York Times Book Review. And you wrote, as a Middle Westerner, the son of immigrant parents, I recognized at an early age that I was called upon to decide for myself to what extent my Jewish origins, my surroundings, my schooling were to be allowed to determine the course of my life. When you were young and realizing that you had these choices to make, what did you see as your options when you were thinking how much your background was going to determine what your future was going to be?
Well, I think that at a very early age, I think before puberty, I'd already decided that I wanted to be a writer, and this really, in a way, drew me apart from my family.
Your father had been a businessman.
Well, my father had been the usual rabbinical student who came to America and found nothing better to do than business, and he didn't do it too well. But he was not rigidly orthodox. I was not imposed on that way. I just wanted to go my own way, and I did.
You also said that you think you might have become a rabbi if the great world, the world of the streets, had not been so seductive. What was seductive? What did you see, and what do you mean by the world of the streets? What exactly were you exposed to?
I mean Chicago in the 20s. I mean the streets, street life, pool rooms, sports, a modicum of criminal activity, which was inescapable in Chicago during the 20s, the bang-bang time of Prohibition and so on. And just the sense that you were participating in the life of this immense and expanding civilization, which was so fascinating that it drew me away from my Jewishness, not so as to make me forget it, but that I wanted to combine it with other things. I mean, I was deeply unwilling to follow anybody's blueprint from either side of the equation.
I've got to ask, you mentioned something about criminal activity. Were you involved in petty crimes yourself?
Well, every kid is involved in petty crimes, always a certain amount of theft and shoplifting and criminal intentions, which are much more powerful than the crimes you commit when you're a kid.
Were you ever caught for anything?
No, I wasn't, no. I was never interested in shoplifting at Woolworths and things like that people used to get caught at. But if I were working in a department store, as I once did, say at a barrel of surprise packages for Christmas, for a quarter apiece, my buddy and I, who were dressed as Santa Claus's helpers, would pocket an occasional quarter. Never got caught.
Mm-hmm.
But I never went in for big-time dishonesty.
Right. So when you were growing up, did you read a lot, too?
Yes, I did.
Did that let you in on other worlds outside Chicago?
Oh, immensely. That was really terrific. Of course, the first book I read was... the first books I read were the opening books of the Old Testament, which I read in Hebrew and translated into Yiddish, which made an enduring impression on me.
Pretty ambitious for starting out, huh?
Well, I think this is the way Jewish kids started out in traditional Orthodox families.
Did your mother want you to be a rabbi?
Oh, definitely, like my grandfather, her father.
And what were your parents' reaction when they figured out that what you wanted to do was right?
Well, my father thought it was a brainstorm. My mother died when I was only 17, so she didn't live to see the worst. But my father was as dismayed at all this and thought it was improvident and so on and so on. I thought he was improvident, watching him run his business.
What kind of business was it?
He was had a coal yard and supplied apartment houses with coal.
Did that seem very boring to you, like the last life in the world you'd
want
to have?
No, it was very. It was not boring at all. It was very exciting. I often worked in the yard, not shoveling coal, but at the scale. So I knew the life at an early age.
You changed your name when you started writing from Solomon Bellows to Saul Bellow. And I was wondering why you changed your name and why you chose the change that you did.
Well, I had been known under both names in the family from the beginning. And, I had a choice open to me. And I simply decided that that Saul would be better than Solomon because of the little verse, Solomon Grundy, born on Monday, etc., etc. And it was just, besides, I wanted to break with everybody, my own family too. So I chose the other name, which was a legitimate name and belong to me.
Chicago is the setting of much of your fiction, but you lived in New York from the 40s through the 60s. And you say that you returned to Chicago when writers became more political in New York. And I was wondering what kind of political expression you wanted to get away from when you left New York.
Oh, well, I just didn't care much for the carrying on about the Vietnam War and so on. I mean, I took my own stand on these matters. I didn't care to be associated with a whole gang of other people.
And did it accomplish what you wanted to move to Chicago in terms of getting away from a group?
Well, I had belonged to a group in New York. I belonged to the old Partisan Review group.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't impose anything on you, and they didn't try to school you in any attitude. They didn't prescribe for you politically. You could think anything you liked. The new outfit wanted to prescribe for you.
Who were you thinking of in the new outfit?
Oh, the mailers and the people like that. People around him. Oh, well, there were several literary establishments that sprang up about that time. There was a New York Review of Books literary establishment. There was the Mailerite establishment. There was the Columbia University establishment, headed by Lionel Trilling and Jacques Barzin, I suppose. I just didn't want to belong to any of these outfits. I had nothing in common with them particularly.
Mm-hmm. In your book, Humboldt's Gift, you refer to, quote, the fastidious goy critics on guard for the Protestant establishment and the genteel tradition. Now, you were really one of the first of the modern Jewish novelists to really make it and reach a wide audience in America. Did you ever feel when you were starting out that you were up against a non-Jewish establishment who might keep you out?
Well, it always helps a young writer to be a belligerent. Militancy is what he chugs along on. So you have to discount. You have to enter a discount for some of this.
Uh-huh.
It's true that we had the experience of first of being locked out, and then of being admitted partly as under the aspect of curiosity, you know. I mean, as Samuel Johnson said about lady poets, they're like dogs that walk on their hind legs. The miracle, what is interesting is not that they do it badly, but that they can do it at all. And I think that this was the category I felt myself being thrust in, and I didn't really like it very much.
What gave you that feeling?
I was battlesome. Well, you know, we had no sooner arrived and begun publishing books, people like Malamud and I, and later on Roth, than we were tagged as Jewish writers. Nobody wants to be tagged in that way. I mean, we thought of ourselves as belonging to the mainstream. We were Americans of Jewish origin. That didn't mean that we had to be tagged that way. And I, for one, really didn't like it. And I jokingly named Roth, Malamud, and myself as the Hartshaffner and Marx of American literature. But that stuck, rather. I mean, the idea that you were not a full partner in this enterprise.
Saul Bellow, recorded in 1989. He died Tuesday at the age of 89. This is Fresh Air. When great artists like Saul Bellow die, we take some consolation in being able to listen back to their words, their ideas, and their voices through tapes in our archive. We're very proud of our archive and very grateful to our listeners for supporting us and enabling us to create this archive. I hope you'll make a pledge today while your station is fundraising. Thank you. The personal is political, people say, but the debates over the president's Social Security proposals have given that phrase a new meaning. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has these thoughts about the dueling adjectives that supporters and opponents of the plan have been using.
Not many people are in a position to evaluate the administration's Social Security plan in all its gnarly details, so a lot is hanging on the way it's branded. The White House has been insisting that the media should use the phrase personal accounts to describe the proposal, which allows people to divert a portion of their payroll taxes into the stock market rather than talking about private accounts or privatization. President Bush says that privatization is a trick word that's simply intended to scare people. And the National Republican Congressional Committee has called it a false and misleading term. The campaign has clearly had an effect on the media. As of last month, the proportion of stories that describe the accounts as personal rather than private had doubled since November. What makes this awkward is that advocates of the administration's plan were talking about privatization and private accounts themselves until recently, when polls and focus groups showed that the words made voters nervous. That's created some delicate moments for the administration, particularly since old habits die hard. A few months ago, the president corrected a Washington Post reporter who asked a question about the administration's privatization plan. "You mean the personal savings accounts?" Bush said. "We don't want to be editorializing." But when the reporter pointed out that the president himself had talked about private accounts and partial privatization just a few months earlier, Bush said, "Maybe I did. It's amazing what happens when you're tired." Some critics have described this linguistic recall campaign as Orwellian, but that really isn't fair. This isn't a question of using a deceptive euphemism in place of an honest description, after all. The administration's merely swapping one vague tag for another when the first one turns out not to poll so well. And with the wisdom of hindsight, supporters of the administration's plan are happy to explain why privatization was actually the wrong word all along. Privatization means you're going to take the program out of the federal government and put it in the hands of private individuals totally, said Republican Jim McCreary, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Social Security. Whereas with the president's plan, McCreary said, people's investment choices are very limited and they can't use the money for anything but buying an annuity when they retire. Critics respond that private is an apt term for a plan that has people turning over their payroll taxes to Wall Street mutual fund managers. But even if Republicans can fight the definition duel to a standoff, their real problem is how to disown private without bailing out on the time-honored Republican rhetoric that goes along with it. Back in 2001, for example, President Bush was saying, "I want to give younger workers the opportunity to manage some of their own money in the private markets." That reference to people's own money is the sort of language that comes with a Republican system disc, along with words like individual, ownership, and choice. But it's hard to square that language with the recent assurances that people won't actually have much control over their accounts. You could hear this strain in the president's remarks at the White House Economic Summit in December. People are not going to be allowed to take their own money for their retirement account and take it to Las Vegas to shoot dice, Bush said. But normally, when a Republican starts a sentence by talking about people's own money, you don't expect him to finish by saying what they're not allowed to do with it. The rhetorical challenge here is to find language that suggests the idea of ownership without actually implying possession. And no word splits that metaphysical seam more neatly than personal does. The president can talk about your own personal account without creating any of the unease that your own private account might engender. After all, your own personal is the phrase that marketers use when they want to convey pride of possession without suggesting that they're conveying title in the bargain. as in not your own exactly, but just for you. Do a Google search on your own personal, and you come up with a staggering 2.5 million hits. Create your own personal coat of arms. MovieTickets.com, your own personal box office. Choose from thousands of tunes to select your own personal ringtone. I got a letter from my bank once telling me that I'd been assigned my own personal banker. I thought that was pretty cool until I realized that all it meant was that there was somebody I could reach at an 800 number without always having to drill down through the phone menu. Your own personal retirement account seems to fit the pattern to a T. As the Republican pollster and language consultant Frank Luntz puts it, when you personalize something, whether monogram towels or Social Security, you enhance ownership by allowing the owner to leave his or her mark on it. The comparison seems fair enough, though I don't know how far Luntz has thought it through. I mean, the thing about personalized towels is that they're not returnable if it turns out they don't keep you dry.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and author of Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Billie Holiday was born 90 years ago today. Here's how she sounded in 1935 when she was 20. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Ooh, what a little moonlight can do. Ooh, what a little moonlight can do to you. You're in love, your heart's a flooding all day long. You only stutter cause your poor tongue just will not utter the word. Wait a while till a little moonbeam comes peeping through. You'll get bored. You can't resist him and all you say when you have kissed him is ooh. What a little moonlight.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the always exasperated comic Louis Black. We'll get to hear what he sounds like when he isn't angry. Black is a regular commentator on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and he has a new memoir. Also, we listen back to a 1993 interview with the writer and teacher Frank Conroy. He died yesterday at the age of 69.
Major funding for CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Louis Black is a stand-up comic and commentator on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, the nightly show of political satire on Comedy Central. Black's political and social commentaries always seem fueled by his anger and exasperation. the cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer has said, Lewis Black has to shout because he knows that no one who counts is listening. We, who do not count, depend on and are grateful for the common sense behind his comic rage. When power corrupts, Lewis erupts. Now Black has a new memoir called Nothing Sacred and a new CD released by Comedy Central Records. Let's start with a commentary he gave on The Daily Show last month.
With our troops overextended, intelligence reform bogged down, gas prices at an all-time high, and millions of kids without health care. It was comforting last week to see Congress take on the most pressing issue of all. Do baseball players use steroids? Here's a hint. Yes! On Thursday, seven former and current big leaguers spoke before Congress in testimony far more riveting than an actual baseball game. The star attraction, 6'5", 220 pounds, able to bench press the mezzanine at Busch Stadium, Mark McGwire. He'll be staring down a tough opponent, the truth.
Well, sir, I'm not here to talk about the past.
Strike one!
Like I said earlier, I'm not going to go into the past and talk about my past.
Strike two!
I'm not here to talk about the past.
Strike three! No one came off worse than Big Mac. At one point, the strain of not answering anything even made him start crying. Crying? There's no crying in baseball testimony. Fortunately, Congressman Mark Sauder wasn't letting him off the hook.
If the Enron people come in here and say, well, we don't want to talk about the past, do you think Congress is going to let them get away with that?
A fascinating hypothetical. What would happen if the Enron guys got dragged before Congress?
I must respectfully decline to answer, on Fifth Amendment grounds, all the questions of this committee and subcommittee.
Will you invoke your Fifth Amendment rights in response to all questions here today?
Yes, I will. I respectfully decline to answer the question based on the protection afforded me under the Constitution of the United States.
Okay. But if the subject had been steroids, they really would have let him have it.
Lewis Black, welcome to Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Can you talk about how this commentary was written, like what the genesis of it was?
Well, I'm going to burst a bubble here. I don't write the commentary, so I perform it. Essentially, for a long time, my segment was an island unto itself. And then John, once he had a vision of the show, began to bring me into the fold by giving us the kind of the topics he wanted us to do. And then we would, so that was already narrowed down. We would do the same sort of thing. I would write, kick it back. And then my career kind of took off and I began to travel more. I wasn't there as much as I could be. And by the time, which is, now this is just about a year and a half, I guess now, 2 years maybe, the writers at the show were writing me, you know, they're writing a better me than I can.
So when the writers write a piece for you, do you have a chance to make any changes you want to?
Oh, yeah, I can throw stuff back to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, what happens is they write it and they send it to me. I look at it, but usually it goes immediately back to the staff there, the guys in charge. They look at it again, they rework it, and then they send it back to me, and then they rework it again. And when I get it, the last time that I get it is usually when I'll throw some things in.
How would you describe your persona on stage?
Basically, a very deeply frustrated individual who expresses his frustration through anger.
And does that describe you off stage too?
No, I don't have the energy for that. people always ask, "Are you like that all the time?" And I said, "If I was like that, I'd be dead."
How did you create this onstage persona of the deeply frustrated, angry guy?
It's always been a part of my personality, and I'd always kind of had that. I never really thought I'd become a comic. I thought I was going to be a playwright.
And so I was doing it on the side for fun, and I would kind of work on, you know, ways to approach it, and nothing was working. And then Dan Ballard, who's a very funny comedian who works out of Michigan, was watching me one night and came up and said, you know, the next time you go back on stage, he said, you know, you start yelling, okay? Because, listen, you're angry. I yell on stage, he said, all the time. I'm not angry, and I'm yelling, and I shouldn't be yelling, and you're angry, and you should be yelling. And that was it, and that really released it all.
Did you model any of your approach on your father or on older people in your family?
I think I modeled it a little bit on my mother and a bit from my grandfather, who was, wow, he was Mr. Angry.
And what would he get angry about, and how would he sound like
everything?
He was angry?
I mean, you know, he was in a constant state of complaint. But he seemed to... like my mother, it's like I've said about my mother, as long as there's something, you know, as long as there's something to be angry about, she will live forever. And my grandfather pretty much had that going. I mean, he would just go, the Vietnam War, he goes, he was like, you know, he sat there in the living room, we're watching the 6 o'clock news, and he goes, you know, he said, if I knew it was going to be like this, I could have stayed in Russia. And I go, you don't want to be there. I said, you're crazy. He says, no, this is... And he goes, no, this is crap. And he would bitch, and I would find it funny.
In your new book, you write a little bit about what you were like as a kid. And you say, for a time, I was a square squared. My mother dressed me in irregular clothing, and my pants were always way, way too baggy. When I asked why they were so big, my mother replied, because you have a big crotch. The top button of my shirt was always buttoned, and I wore big tortoiseshell glasses, so I looked like a dump truck in heat. So, were you a nerdy kid?
Yeah. I really, I hit that period of like 11, 12, which those years which are difficult and fragile at best, mm-hmm. I was pretty nerdy.
Did having big glasses, even when you were a kid, affect your social life?
Oh, yeah. You know, and especially since, as I look back at the pictures, I go, you know, was nobody fashion conscious? My uncle was an optometrist. And so I was going, what was he putting these glasses on my face for?
Now, you say that your parents weren't observant Jews except for like the High Holy Days. But you went to a Yom Kippur service, which is the Day of Atonement for Jewish people. And it really shook you up. What happened?
Well, when I was really young, I'll never forget the first Yom Kippur service because... At first, they play a piece of music that is, I say, all the music that Alfred Hitchcock has in his films. The scary music is based on a thing called the Kol Nidre, where this organ kind of plays. For a kid, it was too spooky for words. It's supposed to, I believe, inspire awe, but when you're, you know, 5 to 8, it inspires panic. And you almost sense that there should be bats flying around, and and then the idea of it is that the day in which God writes your name in the book of life or the book of death, and that was a concept, death, that had not crossed my table. No one in the family had died as of yet. I had never thought of it as something that was hooked up with God. That there was some sort of a power figure that I was supposed to make sure that I kept at bay because he might decide to kill me. And it really had a big effect on me. It scared the hell out of me.
So you started praying compulsively. What were your prayers like?
I did start praying compulsively. It began with, my idea was is that if I had a, because what you do is when you get in there, you apologize for all the bad things you did during the year. And, you know, I was not respectful to my parents. I wasn't nice to my friends, all of this stuff. So whenever a thought or an action that I thought was a red line situation crossed my desk after this, I would immediately respond by having to say something to the effect of, I'm sorry, God. And that started slowly, and then it built up to, I had to say, 10 I'm sorry, Gods. And then it grew as thoughts kind of became a little worse, because I think what occurs when you get into that tape loop as a child is that it's an obsessive compulsive behavior. So the thoughts became worse, and then the prayers became so. Then I have to say I'm sorry, God. And then after I said I'm sorry, God, I had to thank Him. So it was, I'm sorry, God. Thank you, God. Then I began to add breaths in between. So it'd be, I'm sorry, God. I'd have to breathe in. Then I'd go, God. I'd breathe out. And then I'd have to breathe in. Thank you, God. And then breathe out. I had like breath patterns, too, that I got. It was an elaborate system that I had developed that I'm glad isn't on film today.
So did the rabbi know about this?
Nobody knew about it. I never mentioned it to anybody. It was between me and my maker.
So how did you stop?
My grades started to fall. Because I've asked my parents. They don't remember. They never caught me doing it. My friends at school, because of the breathing patterns, there were kids sitting around me looking at me going, what is the matter with you? You know, because I'd stop in the middle of a test and go through this. And my parents took me to a some sort of a counselor or psychiatrist at the University of Maryland, and I went once, and I knew I didn't really want to talk about it, so I'd better stop it. And I really did. It stopped me on a dime.
Well, Lewis Black, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, this was really a pleasure. I really had a good time.
Lewis Black has a new memoir called Nothing Sacred. Tomorrow we'll hear from Daily Show correspondent Stephen Colbert. Coming up, we listen back to a 1993 interview with the writer and teacher Frank Conroy. He died yesterday at the age of 69. This is Fresh Air. The writer and teacher Frank Conroy died yesterday at the age of 69 of colon cancer. For 18 years, he directed the Writer's Workshop at the University of Iowa, where he helped shape the early work of some now important writers. He also wrote a 1967 memoir called Stop Time that is now considered a classic. In Conroy's New York Times obituary today, Charles McGraw described Stop Time as a lucid and evocative memoir that has been a model for countless young writers, the sort of book that is passed along like a trade secret. But after Stop Time, Conroy's life fell apart. It wasn't until 18 years later that he completed his second book, a collection of short stories called Mid-Air. I spoke with Conroy in 1993, after the publication of his novel Body and Soul, the story of a young music prodigy who lives in poverty but finds a wonderful, dedicated teacher and goes on to become a great musician. I asked Frank Conroy if there were any parallels between him and his character.
I've played the piano all my life. In fact, I played professionally as a jazz pianist for about 5 years, and sort of Bush League for another 5 years. I played jazz, and I don't. The hero of this book is a prodigy and is a very, very good pianist. I'm a competent jazz pianist. I didn't have a teacher. In a way, that's probably, you know, that every novel contains fantasies, I think. And this one, fantasies about teachers and father figures. And I didn't have a father. I didn't have a teacher. But Claude does, you see.
Well, your father left the family when you were about three or something.
That's right. He was a manic depressive, so he was institutionalized most of the time. They didn't have lithium in those days.
And what about not having a piano teacher? What was the reason for that?
There was a boarder in our apartment who was a professional musician, and there was an attempt at him giving me some lessons, but he was a sadistic psychopath, and it turned me off. It turned me off very rapidly. The whole idea of piano lessons, he used to squeeze my neck with his fingers, and say, he really was. He was nuts. But so I went back and I learned myself. I learned very slowly. At first, I learned the blues, boogie woogie, which I picked up, off the radio from Harlem uptown, and I just stuck with it. In the writing of this book, I had to go back and really re-educate myself about music from the beginning on, and I had to learn some new stuff, some stuff that I didn't know. The 12th tone. In particular, was a challenge.
It's funny, coming out of a background where you had no father figure and no teacher, you kind of went on to, among other things, become a very well-known teacher as the head of the writers program at the University of Iowa.
Yes, and I also have three sons.
We're listening to a 1993 interview with writer Frank Conroy. He died yesterday. Conroy's influential memoir, Stop Time, was published in 1967, but it was 18 years before his next book was published.
I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, but what happened in the interim?
A certain amount of trouble in my life, a sort of serious trouble. The end of my first marriage, I had to leave my two kids, which was difficult for me because, my father left. My mother died a very long, slow process, and there was really nobody else to look after her except me, and that was very draining. And it was a difficult time. Also, I didn't have any money, and I'd spent so many years writing. I really didn't have the training to do any kind of ordinary job, so it was tough. It was a tough time.
What was it like for you to be looking after your mother? From your memoir, Stop Time, you'd get the feeling your mother didn't always do such a good job looking after you.
That's true. I hope I did a better job, but good heavens! I mean, the woman was dying. I mean, and I had to, I went to the first of all, getting her into a hospital was hard. Then she was in, then she was out, and then I took her back in the last time. If you've read my story, Midair, there's a story in there where it's autobiographical, and it's one of these things. It really happened, but it's one of those things you can't put into a story because it's too convenient. I was driving her to the hospital for what I knew would be the last time, down the Merritt Parkway from Connecticut into New York. And we had both been so preoccupied with this that we forgot. And as we were driving along, suddenly it got dark and everything changed in the exterior world. It's because there was an eclipse of the sun, mm-hmm. And that actually happened. So I put it in the story.
Boy, that is the kind of thing I think you might have been afraid to put in the story because it seems like it's too much the metaphor.
Yes, but it happened. I mean, not that that's really any defense. Students will often say that to me, but it happened, you know. And I say, well, I don't care if it happened. It isn't any good. But there, I just couldn't stop myself from doing it. I put it in and I thought it worked.
Frank Conroy, recorded in 1993. He died yesterday at the age of 69. This is Fresh Air. It saddens me to think how many of our interviews later become obituaries, but I'm grateful that we so often have tapes to play to help us pay tribute to writers, musicians, and performers who have left us. I'm also grateful to you, our listeners, for supporting our program and enabling us to create this archive of interviews. Your station is fundraising today. Please call with a pledge. Thank you. Let's get back to our 1993 interview with the writer Frank Conroy. He's the author of the now classic memoir Stop Time. For 18 years, he directed the writer's workshop at the University of Iowa. Conroy died yesterday of colon cancer. He was 69.
Your father was a drinker, and you went through a period when you were drinking a lot, too. Did that make it even worse? Did you have this fear of that you were picking up some of the habits of a man who you barely knew?
Well... I don't think I felt I was picking up his. I mean, whatever sins or stupid things or self-destructive things I was doing were really not modeled after anyone. They were. I found them myself. You know. But yes, indeed. I mean, it's funny. I've noticed this about a lot of artists. They have a very peculiar relationship to their body. As if it's just some old suitcase you have to lug around with you, some old battered up suitcase. And so there's a, you know, and I certainly had that. I mean, I didn't take care of myself, and I drank too much. I smoked a lot. I finally stopped smoking. But, you know, yes, I didn't help matters, I think, by the various methods that I used to escape the depression and the confusion that I felt.
Well, I really like your description about how a lot of artists see their body. Yes.
Yeah, it's well, we live in our heads so much,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
The important stuff really takes place in some kind of hyperspace inside the brain or inside the imagination. And I know a number of Marilyn Robinson. I was talking to her. It turns out that you know I write in bed. I always have ever since the beginning. I put up pillows behind my back. And, you know, I put the legal pad across my knees and write. And it's funny. I mean, I really need to do that. And I found out that Marilyn also writes in bed. And we were laughing about it because what we're trying to do, of course, is sort of deny the existence of our bodies at all. You know, you get in bed.
Right.
As if, you know...
As if it's time to dream and just, like, lose consciousness.
Yes, and, you know, you do everything to sort of minimize your physical awareness of your body while you enter the dream of the work, you know, and you're concentrating very intensely. And, you see pictures and you hear sounds and smell smells and you're doing all of this. And your body seems to have nothing to do with it.
Well, did that ever change for you? Did you ever get to feel that... you had to take care of your body and kind of
sure it did
be a part of your physical self and all
yeah,
of that.
Yeah, sure it did.
What brought you around on that?
Well, a couple of things. One, I went too far, and so I finally woke up that, hey, Frank, you know, I said to myself, this is crazy. You know, you better stop this stuff. So there was that, and then there was the birth of my third child, who is 6 years old, and that changes things. And advancing age, you know, I'm 57. So I stopped smoking. I didn't stop drinking. I still drink a little bit in the evening, maybe a little bit too much sometimes, but it's very much under control, and I live a very stabilized life and have for quite a while.
Your memoir, Stop Time, begins and ends with you in a Jaguar driving very fast from London to about 20 miles south of the city where you lived.
Yes.
And the prologue is about the release of that drive, the release of driving really fast in a sports car.
Yeah.
The epilogue is the car crash, where you nearly get killed and you're miraculously saved because the car nearly gets wrapped around a fountain.
Yes. That was prophetic, wasn't it?
What do you mean?
I mean... in Stop Time, that's a warning. And in a sense, maybe I was warning myself because it wasn't a car and a particular fountain, but I was living pretty dangerously later, and I was lucky to get out unscathed.
Do you still vividly remember the moment of the crash?
No, I was pretty drunk. and it was late. I remember it, but I remember more what I was thinking than I have an actual sense memory of the event. You know, I remember more what I was thinking, which is that I was really, it seemed to me that, you know, I clearly was, I could die. I mean, and I remembered, it was interesting because it didn't particularly frighten me.
You think that's because you were drunk?
No, it happened to me later when I was sober. I had at one point, about 10 years ago, I had a hemorrhaging duodenal ulcer. And I went to the hospital real fast. And the doctor told me later that I had 15 minutes, you know, I had tops. If it had been 15 minutes longer, I would have been DOA. But I knew when I was in that emergency room, when you see that there are 9 people around you and every one of them is doing something, you know that you're in trouble. And, of course, I was bleeding. I was hemorrhaging. There was blood all over the emergency room. And I knew I could die right then. And I didn't feel frightened. And that time I was certainly quite sober. I didn't feel frightened. I felt like, what a shame. I mean, this is too early. I've got stuff to do.
Frank Conroy, recorded in 1993. He died yesterday of colon cancer. He was 69. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the inside story of how fake news is reported. We talk with Stephen Colbert, a correspondent for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. We'll hear some of his fake news exclusives and talk with him about how he gets his scoops. Join us for the next Fresh Air.